Good morning.
Good morning.
How have you enjoyed the conference so far? Did I promise you a wow?
Yes.
It's a wow. Thank you for coming to this session. This is going to be one of the most exciting, interesting, and informative sessions you will ever attend in your life. My friend here, Margaret McKenna, has had and continues to have an amazing career. I said, if you think about life as a pizza pie, normally it has 8 slices, and every slice is a piece of your career. So we're going to eat the pie this morning. Sausage, pepperoni, vegetarian, whatever you prefer. And I'm here to introduce Margaret McKenna. When you have a minute, look in your book and read her full description. Margaret is an icon in our world of women leaders. She has been involved at the forefront in human rights, civil rights, White House, higher education, business, you name it, she has been at the forefront. Look at all the women nodding their heads. You know a little bit about her. You think you know a little bit about her? Well, wait till you hear the details. And we're going to have time for Q&A, so get your Q's ready, because we have A's. So I'm going to start by just asking Margaret to talk a little bit, and I'm going to kind of, this is rapid fire. Margaret, talk a little bit about your early and first, everything is a first, White House experience.
Good morning. I sound a little bit like Lauren Bacall. Most of you are too young to know who Lauren Bacall was. But it's the tail end of my illness here. I'm so glad I could be here this morning. I was the first woman deputy counsel to President Carter. President Carter, for those of you who are...
Wait, we have applause right here. Go right ahead. And another lawyer led that round
right,
of applause.
Right. For those of you of a certain age, President Carter was not the president in between, you know, Lincoln and someone. When I tell my undergraduates, President Carter, they go like, which one was he? What year? So I was 30 years old when I became the deputy counsel to the president. I had an office in the West Wing, right over the vice president. So I was the first woman, one of the few women in the White House. And I was in the White House with a bunch of guys from Georgia. So it was a very interesting time. Actually, I had been a civil rights lawyer in the Justice Department, doing employment discrimination, suing police and fire departments around the country for race discrimination.
Do we need her now or what?
I ran the Carter campaign, Carter Mondale campaign in Rhode Island. It was my first political campaign, really. I ran the state, and I worked in the transition. I know a little bit about transitions if you want to know about what's going on in a transition. So I wanted to go to work for the Labor Department. And I was sitting in my office in the transition, and the counsel to the president, who was a good friend of President Carter's, was running the Justice Department transition. He said, I want you to come to the White House to be my deputy. And I thought, I want to go to the Labor Department. Because the White House was very political, you know, a lot of elbows. And I was, I'm sort of a policy person, not a political person, is the way I saw myself. And so I'm sitting there in jeans with my feet up on the desk, and I look up, and there's Jimmy Carter. He comes in, and he says, Margaret, I understand you don't want to work for me in the White House. I was like, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. Very articulate. And I said, yes, sir. So anyway, that was how I became the deputy counsel. And I was involved in everything that you can imagine, everything from Three Mile Island to the Iran hostage situation to the selection of federal judges, to working with the State Department and the Justice Department, negotiating disputes between agencies, Particularly the role I played with federal judges is one of the ones I'm most proud of. President Carter appointed more women federal judges than about 16%. The largest percent any president before that had appointed was 1%.
Let's hear it for the man from Plain. That's right.
And Griffin Bell, in his book about his term, he was the attorney general, called me meddlesome, that I was a troublemaker in the White House, and I overstepped my bounds.
This is great. I love this. Audience participation. I love this. Well, Margaret, you see, she's already used up two slices of the pie. Great careers. And I didn't introduce myself because some of you have known me over the years, but I'm Marion Hurd. I'm a founding board member of this conference. And, ooh, thank you. And we normally kick off the conference and then move through to do panels and workshops like this. And you would not be surprised that I raised my hand when asked about sitting with Margaret. So now we're going to move on to another slice of the pie, and I'm going to ask Margaret to talk about, again, a first. Think about it, a first. Talk a little bit about Walmart.
Yes. So I was I was the president of Lesley University.
We're going to get back to that.
I don't know, any Lesley people
Lesley
here?
Lesley people here. Oh, right here, right there.
Right there.
Okay.
So when I retired from Lesley University after 22 years, I thought I had actually retired. I'm not very good at retirement. And a friend of mine had been lobbying for Walmart. I had lunch with him in Washington, and he said, you need to look at this job at Walmart. I said, I wouldn't work for Walmart if it was the last place on earth.
She's also a diplomat.
Yeah. And I said, I'm a civil rights person. I can't work for Walmart. And the way they treat people, I'm no way. He said, this is the opportunity to run the foundation. They've been looking for somebody 15 months. They want to change what they do. You'll have a lot of autonomy, you know, really. And they're looking for someone with some national credibility. They've always hired somebody from inside. You need to look at them. So I went back. I looked at all of the work, all of the information about big box stores, and they're all terrible. And but what I found out is that Walmart is, you know, is good or better than any of them. It's not any worse. Maybe Costco. But other than that, it isn't any worse. So I said, well, at least I'll go talk to them. And so I did. And I thought, you know, they give away a lot of money. I'm of a certain age. If I go there and it doesn't work, I'll just leave. So I went. And I was the first person to hold this job as president of the Walmart Foundation in Bentonville, Arkansas.
Has anybody ever been to Bentonville? You see, a lot of people.
Wow.
Yeah, I've been to Bentonville. Have you been to the Crystal Bridges Museum? Yeah, see, three people. It's amazing.
You went to Bentonville because you work for a company who was a vendor?
No, that's Arkansas.
Ah, all right, hey. So they were very suspicious of me. Because I was from the Northeast, I was a Yankee and a communist, basically. A communist, feminist, liberal, elite person. But, you know, they hired me. And I ran the foundation for 4 years. And what I found out was, in the end, I was giving away $1 billion a year. That's a B, not an M.
Did everybody hear that? Walmart was giving away $1 billion. But Margaret, tell them a little bit about your food program.
Well, one of the things that I found out was that they did not pay a lot of attention to where I was giving the money away because it was only $1 billion a year. Yeah. So I had a lot of freedom. And when I got there, I had the opportunity to define the program. And when I got there, there were no priorities. So I defined the priorities as hunger as being one of them, food relief. And what I found out when I first got there is that the company itself was throwing away all their food. And they did not donate food. And so one of my priorities was to get the company to donate food. Now, I run the foundation, not the company, which several people reminded me of several times. But I knew that, and I learned in my 4 years there, that giving away $1 billion a year meant nothing next to making the company, having the company move one inch in their behavior, because the company is the largest in the world, right? So they make one change in personnel or one change in policy, it affects the world, and $1 billion is only $1 billion. And so I worked for 6 months in concentric circles trying to find allies around the company to change the policy so that they would give away food. And people have been talking about it for a decade, but had never made the decision because they kept saying, the general counsel won't let us do it, the logistics people won't let us do it, the transportation people won't let us do it. And so at the end of 6 months, working through the company, the president of the company agreed, and the company is now the largest donor of food in the United States. And the foundation, before I left, we made a $2 billion commitment, which they have surpassed. They're the largest donor of food in the United States. Even if you add everybody else together, they're larger. All the other supermarkets, they're larger. And the foundation joined together and added food trucks for every food bank in the country, including the food bank here, has trucks donated by Walmart to pick up food. So you can do frozen foods, fast frozen foods, produce, and healthy foods donated. And Walmart is also the largest donor to summer food for kids in the country. And that all happened because it was the foundation working with the company. So I'm very proud of the work there. And it was a lesson learned for me because, you know, I always had worked in the nonprofit sector and in government. And what I learned was working inside a company, the power of that leverage point for change. And when I think about affecting the world, that one change, and now it's all over the world. Walmart gives away their food.
Outstanding.
All over the world.
We're going to talk a little bit about Suffolk University, and I'm going to then go back to Leslie because that's her longest tenured place. But if you think about it, Margaret has already used up 5 slices of her 8-slice pie. The political arena, the White House, the legal side, the justice side, the Walmart side. Yeah, exactly. So she's got very little left to share with you. You cannot have a piece of pie. So let's talk a little bit about Leslie. When Margaret went to Leslie College, it was kind of a sleepy, wonderful place. And when she left it, it was an even more so magnificent university. So talk a little bit about Leslie, because you transformed that institution, the physical plant, the programs, the connections from the NCAA to programs to adding the PhD effort. Talk a little bit about what happened at Leslie. Talk about change agent right here. Talk about Leslie.
Yeah. I love Leslie University. Its mission is incredible. I still love the place. Change is hard. I talk a lot to new CEOs and new college presidents, and I talk about change, leadership and change. And I say to new college presidents, new CEOs of nonprofits, Marian, you do this a lot too, I know. And I say, if you take this job and you are talking about change and you want to be loved, get a dog. And I had two. Because change is tough.
It's hard.
It's hard. And if you want radical change and you have a project and you think you've changed everything and everybody still loves you, you probably haven't done enough, right? So, but, you know, one of the things you learn too, and I learned at Lesley, is if you, the lesson I learned doing that, a couple of lessons. One is do what you do best and only do what you do as well or better than anyone else. Don't chase something that's popular that day or that year. So do is only do what you do as well or better than anyone else. So focus. And that really, the mission was so important. So one of the things we did at Lesley is we had a school of management and we closed it down. It was making money and we closed it because it didn't fit with the mission. And we focused on our mission. And we grew from a place of 2,500 to 10,000, from an endowment of $1 million to 180 million. And
yeah, we heard a wow over here. Yeah, it's a wow. Think about it.
And but the lesson was really not trying to be all things to all people. It was really trying to be. You know, I used to talk about Lesley's mission and say, we're a place that's interested in the common good. We're interested in social justice, and sometimes people would, and we're a feminist institution. And I remember a faculty member coming to me and saying, you can't say that. No, I just did. I said, well, people won't come. I said, that's right. But that's who we are, and you know, we respect women. That's our history. We were a women's institution founded by a woman, and people make choices. Now, that doesn't mean we're not going to expose people to every philosophy and every ideology, but we stand for something. And you know, I think universities who say they don't have any ideology mean they're white, male, and Western. So, I'm, you know, very proud of what happened at Lesley. It is a place that has a mission that, you know, produces people who give themselves to others and change the world and don't make a lot of money. But other than that, it's a wonderful, wonderful place.
See, another slice of the pie. So talk a little bit about Suffolk. Margaret, again, first, right here in Boston, took a job as president of Suffolk University, and some of you are nodding your heads. We have a lot of female college presidents in the region. Some succeeded other women. Some were first, and some are still first. So Margaret, talk a little bit about what happened at Suffolk, and the most important thing, why you took the job. Because her predecessors had come and gone in rapid succession. So she was coming in after a lot of personnel changes. So talk a little bit about Suffolk.
I was at the Heller School at Brandeis. I sort of moved from college to college in this town, I guess. And I had left Walmart. And I was asked to apply at Suffolk. I said no, I wasn't interested in being a university president again. Anyway, long story short, they convinced me to come and take the job. And the reason I went to Suffolk was because it's such an important urban institution in the city of Boston. First generation kids, it has a mission for social justice, public policy. A third of the state legislators have degrees from Suffolk. I don't know whether that's good or bad, but they do. The City Hall and the State House are full of Suffolk grads. And so it's very important that Suffolk educate well. And very important, you know, in the city of Boston, it used to be Boston College, was a place where local kids went, and then it was Northeastern. It's Suffolk, right? In terms of private institutions, UMass Boston and Suffolk. So I'm a public policy person. I'm interested in access. And it had a very troubled history. And I'm like to fix things. And I knew that the chairman of the board and the whole, a lot of the board was stepping down. And I thought this was an opportunity to fix it. And that's why I took the job. So what basically happened is, you know, one force met another force, change. And it just didn't work out that way. And they were not willing to change. And the people who were going to step down decided they weren't going to step down. And we came to a point where it just didn't work out that way. So I mean, I think that there are a lot of things that did change. We did get them to change the bylaws and brought some attention to the issues that are there in terms of governance and other issues. The accreditors and the attorney general are paying a lot of attention to what goes on. I think that some good things happen. It is a wonderful, important place in the city of Boston and deserves all good things that come to it.
And Margaret's modest, too. Talk a little bit about the changes. In her brief tenure there, talk about the enrollment and what you did. And not only, as she said, this caught the attention of the Attorney General and the accreditation bodies. Change is never easy, but through it all, she moved the institution from here to here.
Yeah, well, we did.
You're having trouble hearing me?
Yeah.
Not anymore, thank you.
Well, in spite of everything that was going on, we brought in the second largest first year class in history.
No, pause there. Let's have a round of applause.
And we created a public policy hub. We created the first fitness center. We added six new athletic teams. You know, and I think we actually turned around the morale in the institution for the first time in a long time. So a lot of good things happened, and I basically feel bad for leaving the place and all those people. I feel like I left my family behind and I abandoned them, you know. Downstairs in the exhibit center, I saw two of my young admissions people. I wanted to go up and hug them, you know. It's okay, you'll be okay. So it's a great place, and it deserves a lot of support.
Perfect.
It's a good place.
We're going to take some questions, get your questions ready. And I'm also going to ask Margaret to reflect a little on what she has learned from each of these experiences. Because every institution is different, the culture is different, how you negotiate between departments, divisions, and faculty and employees. And you bring different skills to every position. But if you are open to it, you also learn, and you learn from other people. So, God bless you. So I'm going to ask Margaret to talk a little bit about what she has learned in each of these experiences or collectively, and then get your questions ready, and we're going to take some questions from the audience. Margaret. So
I've learned a lot of things. I've learned to be successful, you have to listen a lot. You have to respect the past. I find that the least experienced managers come in and want to throw out everything. Anything that's happened in the past, they ignore, and they want to change everything. And if you're the more experienced and more confident you are, you absolutely embrace everything that's good in you, and you own it, right? I mean, it's so disappointing when somebody, isn't it, when some new supervisor comes in and says, we're not going to do that anymore, right? So, I mean, it's so important to build on what is. I've learned the lesson is when I first came to Lesley, in fact, I was not an academic, right? I'm a lawyer by training. And I hired people who had skill sets different than mine, which is what people tell you, right? You hire people whose competencies are different than yours. So what I learned was hire people who share your values, because you can teach skills, but you cannot teach values.
Did everybody hear that? That's a very important comment, particularly for young people just starting their careers or in the mid-level.
So, you know, you want to hire skilled people, but I remember hiring somebody at Lesley who was a highly skilled academic dean, but she wanted to be at Bowdoin. And she kept trying to make Lesley into Bowdoin. I said, go to Bowdoin. You know, Lesley could be a third-rate Bowdoin. We don't want to be a third-rate Bowdoin. We want to be a first-rate Lesley. And it's so important that the values, you want them to... I want people to love my place and my mission. And I don't want you to want it to be somewhere else. So that, I think that's really, really important. And so that's a hard lesson, I think, for people to learn. You know, I have to tell you one story about Walmart too. About culture. You're from Arkansas. Here's a person from Arkansas. A few people from Arkansas. So this may not be a surprise because you know Walmart, but I have to tell this one story about Arkansas, about not Arkansas, but about Walmart. I was there 8 months and I had my first evaluation at Walmart with the president of the company, the whole company, the president of the biggest company in the world, right? I was like, okay. An EVP and the president of the whole company. So I'm sitting there and, Margaret, you've done an amazing job. You know, you've put the priorities and you've done, okay. You do have some opportunities. That's what we call them at Walmart. Do you have companies they call opportunities? So that was new to me, see, in the nonprofit, we don't call them opportunities. We say, you have some things you could do better. We just like, speak the truth, you know, it's like, oh, we think there's things you could improve. Okay, so opportunities. So, okay. So if you accepted the Walmart culture, we think you would be even more productive. And so some people think you're a little too aggressive. And if you were a little less aggressive and more like us, more like our culture, you would be more successful. And if you were a little more ladylike, you would probably find it easier here. What's the lesson I learned out of that one is not to laugh right out loud when somebody says that. So, you know, I guess the other lesson I learned in all of that, a bigger picture lesson, you know, from my Walmart experience, my government experience, nonprofit experience is that real change, and we're seeing now, and one of the other things I did is when Bill Clinton was elected, I ran the education transition for him. So I've seen all kinds of things. I ran the education transition for Tom Menino in Boston. Is real significant change takes government, nonprofit, and the corporate world. Real change. And it takes a real combination. And that's a lesson I saw work when I saw the kinds of things that Walmart could make happen. So it's something, as I see now with the transition going on, is how things change and how we can make things happen or not happen.
Perfect. We're going to take some questions. We have any right here? We have a microphone right over there. Just step right up to the microphone. Right here. You're going to have a question?
Here, this woman in the gray is first, and just line up, then we'll do the questions. We'll go back and forth. Well, you're ready. Go ahead with the green dress. Go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Christy Anthony. I work in higher education and Title IX administration in the Boston area. And with the incoming administration, I recognize it will be very difficult to predict how that area will transform. But I'm wondering if you could outline what you think might be some bellwether events to look for or canaries in the coal mine. Sorry, it's the first question. Yeah.
You know, to be honest, I have no idea, because the woman who's the proposed Secretary of Education, you know, really has very little background. She's, you know, as you know, her main issue has been vouchers and all kinds of vouchers. And that's it. She's just been interested in all children having vouchers, to take those vouchers and be able to use them any way they wanted. And other than that, we don't know anything about her, except that her family owns Amway and Blackwater.
She's a billionaire.
And so, she's a billionaire.
Right. So in answer to your question, we just have to pray. Next.
And no, whatever's in the, it's not going to be just canaries either.
Right, that's right.
It's bigger than canaries.
Next question, right here.
I actually have a really simple question. I'm Holly Moody, and I've been in...
Just speak up, Holly. We can't quite hear you.
I'm sorry. Yes, Holly Moody. Been in the engineering field for a very, very, very long time, as I'm nearing retirement. And you said something that actually touched me. You mentioned a leverage point, finding a leverage point. What do you look for? What constitutes a leverage point? And how do you sort of, you know, I mean, I've tried to affect change many, many, many ways. And, you know, you fall down and you fail. And then you pick yourself up and you try again and you try again. And I know...
So what's the leverage point?
So
what do you look for, Margaret?
You know, in different places, it's different things. And I think the important thing is to find it. And then, you know, when I was younger, and I'm sure Mary and you too, is I would just go barreling in, right? Now, what is wrong with you people? Why don't you fix this? You know, simple justice, make this happen. You know, and now, you know, I must say, I'm surprised I still have a tongue after biting it so many times at Walmart in terms of things people said. I just learned one of the things as I had to pick and choose. And what I did at Walmart in terms of find, there were lots of places I could have weighed in. And I literally sort of figured out, and the way, reason I chose hunger was because, this is how I decided, was Walmart was the largest grocer in the U.S. So I had to find something that made a difference to them, right? So shared value, something that they could understand that would make a difference to them. And then I had to do concentric circles of support. So those are the two things I thought of.
Perfect.
Thank you.
We have over here.
Hi, I'm Kelly Chun. I have a public relations and marketing business based here in Boston. We provide culturally smart strategies.
No commercials, Kelly.
To
just,
promote
what's the question?
Social change.
What's the
and
question?
It social is change. Related to social change, Marion Heard.
Yeah, go.
So I'll get to the question.
That's the question.
In all of your spheres of influence, what have you learned about managing crises? And crisis management.
Yes.
You said change is hard, so how do you manage crises? What have you learned about that?
One of the things I've learned about managing crises is that a lot of people think that there's a crisis that it's not a crisis. People overreact, I find. I tell people, you know, take a breath. I can't tell you how many times I've said to people, take a breath, take 10, wait 24 hours. People overreact to things, I find, a lot of times. And then, you know, have good heads involved, a group of people involved. Clearly, in places, you should have a crisis team in place. But day to day, I find people overreact to things, and it's just amazing how people overreact to things. But on the other side of the thing, in a big organization or an organization, you should certainly have plans in place to react to a real crisis. Right. So both ends.
Yeah, they're usually laid out. Good question. Yes, over here.
Hi, my name is Shauna Schufelt, and I'm a new politician. I was recently elected to the Board of Selectmen in the town where I live. I'm not the first woman, but I'm the first woman in a very long time. And my question is, I frequently find that people are uncomfortable with how to address me, especially when we're talking about formal hearings.
How about Zarina?
So, Shauna, it's Shauna. So people in the more formal context, people are uncomfortable with how to address me, or they'll frequently address the board as gentlemen and that kind of thing. And what I'm curious about is, how much do you kind of like make people feel okay that they just made a mistake? And how much do you just let them just stew in that uncomfortableness when they realize they've done something wrong?
Depends on your mood of the day. Sometimes you can let it fly, you can let it slide, and then sometimes they need an education. Margaret was talking about the words abrasive, assertive, etc. Be more ladylike. When's the last time you heard somebody say to a guy, be more manlike? So every now and then you have to push back. Margaret?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the situation. Right. I think, you know, part of our job, our lifelong job, is to educate people. But there's no question in the world that, you know, gender makes a difference here. I mean, we are continually interrupted, women. How many times, when was the last time you heard a man say, may I ask a question? Right? When was the last time a guy knocked on the door and waited at your office? I mean, they knock on the door and they come in, right? Women are like, heaven forbid. So, I mean, the world, gender still makes a difference. And I think it's your decision. I mean, what do you want to be called? And then you decide that. And then that's what you should have people do.
Exactly. Over here.
It's up to you.
Hi.
Queen. Take Queen. But Zarina is my preference because nobody else has that title. Yes.
My name's Cheryl. I work for the Federal Reserve. I was just curious if you could just share with us what you feel is the greatest obstacle facing women professionally today, and if you have any advice on what that obstacle is.
Well, I think gender is still an issue, less of an issue than it was. I think there are still stereotypes. I also think, let me tell you about one study that was done, which I think is relevant. There was a study done of women superintendents of schools, and superintendents of schools often move from district to district. And because the school committee, there's a woman who was just elected here as a selectman, school committees get elected and a new school committee comes in, they have a different view, and the superintendent's term is up and they get a new superintendent. So you can say they were fired or their term was up. So the male superintendent just goes on to another superintendency, and they have three of them or four of them. So male superintendents, when you say, this is your third superintendency, what happened to the other two? And they say, well, the school committee, you know, I moved too fast. They didn't understand what I was trying to do. The politics were wrong. What do women superintendents say? They say, I made a mistake. I didn't do the right thing. Women internalize while men externalize. Men go like, it was their fault. Women go, it was my fault. I should have, could have done better. I was great. They were too slow. I did the right thing. They didn't understand. So one of the problems is to keep self-confidence up when things happen to you, and don't understand that, you know, there are still some gender issues around, and make sure that you have the support and the professional development you need to keep moving along. The other thing I would say is make sure you find the right person to work for. And you have a mentor, a man or a woman, who's going to support you. It's very important to have models and mentors and supporters as you go through. Very important. And some people, and Mary and I'm sure, and I do, have people that I've been involved with, young people, for 20 years. You know, I can tell you now, I have a woman, two women who are college presidents now, one who's an EVP at Yale, and I mean, you know, women who are all over who work for me when they were, I say, kids, you know, who are doing different things all over. So, you know, you establish those relationships early, and they can pick up the phone and call you for a long time. That's very important to have.
Very important.
Thank you.
Question over here.
Hi, my name is Michelle. I'm an executive in the technology industry. You spoke about working in a house full of men from Georgia and being in Arkansas at the highest corporate levels, driving hard change, sometimes unpopular change. Do you have any guidance for us around maintaining energy and motivation in, you know, in the face of all of that? How do you every day get up and do it again? Sorry.
So I have always chosen jobs. My mission in life has been around access for people who don't have it, social justice and access. And my Walmart Foundation job was around using that money to give people access and opportunity. And so I was driven by that. I mean, I had a pot of money to give away. And to tell you the truth, I was able to give that to every organizations all over the country. I mean, you know, summer learning, the Environmental Defense Fund, who was suing Walmart at the time I gave money to. You know, the Hispanic Scholarship Fund, the NAACP, and so, I, if you're working for an organization that you know is affecting people's lives in a positive way, even if it's hard to do, then you go do it. You know, if you're working for an organization whose mission you don't believe in and it's hard, then you're, you know, either have to love your job every day because the environment is great, which at Walmart it was not, or you have to really be focused on your mission is really important. You got to have one or the other. I mean, you got to work for an organization where it's great and fun to be, and the person you work for is great, or the mission has to be really important, right? You got to have one or the other, right? Or you go home and cry every night. I actually, when I went first couple months, I was at Walmart. It was so hard because I was used to working in places where, you know, you turned around, and somebody was behind you. You had a team, and I remember talking to the woman who was the head of people, it was called. Do you people have people now? No? At Walmart, they call it the head of people, not HR. So, and I said to her, this is a really hard place to work. I said, you know, people seem fearful, and, you know, it doesn't seem to be a big team. She said to me, for the first 6 months I was here, I went home and cried every day. And I said, is that supposed to make me feel good? I said, you're the head of people. Can't you fix that? I mean, I was like amazed. She thought that was okay. She went home and cried every day. And so that's the way you're supposed to be when you first come to work at Walmart. You go home and cry every day, and then you feel better. And then on the seventh month, anyway, that was like amazing anyway. So, I mean, you got to have one or the other. If you're in a place where you don't believe in the mission and the work environment is bad, boy, you need to spiff up your resume and find another place to be.
Great, thank you.
Okay, over here.
Hi, my name is Sue. I'm with the Boston Consulting Group. And I wanted to hear a little bit more about what you didn't say after that Be More Ladylike performance review, in the sense of, you know, how do we as women not be defensive, you know, hear the input and the feedback that we're being given, which is often valuable, but also sort of separate it from some of the gender biases. And then also, you know, how do we make it not a polarizing issue and draw men into it, right? It's great that there are a few men here, but how do we bring them into it and become partners and really leverage each other so that it's not you're aggressive, which you never hear about a man, but also you get things done, right? Like, how do you strike that balance?
So how do you accept criticism and move forward?
Yeah, but also the gender criticism that's
right.
often there,
okay.
but that may have some valuable elements to
yeah.
it.
I'm going to give it to Margaret, but let me just tell you, I had yeah. a friend who was an executive at a telecommunications company in Connecticut, and she got ready to fire a fellow. And under his breath, as he was leaving her office, he used the B word. So I FedExed a T-shirt to her, and I kept a supply in my office. She was one of the women, as Margaret said, that I had mentored for probably 15, 18 years. It's a great T-shirt. I keep thinking I should print them and sell them. And I told her to put it on the back of a chair and have him come back in, because he stormed out and she didn't quite finish the meeting. The T-shirt simply says, "That's Ms. Bitch to you." So it's a great one. It's a great one. So this happens all the time. So I'm going to throw it to Margaret. But we have to also toughen up. We have to toughen up. Toughen up. Toughen up. My staff in Connecticut, and we were the number one program United Way in America, gave me two pair of cleats. One cleat pair had rubber tips, and the other one had steel tips. And as appropriate, I'd pull out the one appropriate for the day. So you can't just always take it. You have to often push back and give it. Margaret.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. I did have an opportunity to go back and talk to the CEO. And I was on a task force, and they were talked about a lot about diversity at Walmart. And actually, to tell you the truth, the president of Walmart now, Doug McMillon, I have enormous respect for. He's really trying to change the company. He's meeting a lot of headwinds, but he's trying to change the company. And so not him, his predecessor. And I said, you know, you avow that you want to have diversity. And at the same time, what you said to me is, you want me to accept your culture. I'm 63 years old. I've worked in all these different jobs, but you want me to be like you. That's not diversity. You're saying you want me to give up who I am and be like you. Diversity means different styles, different backgrounds, different cultures. If you want diversity, it means diverse everything. And you're expecting everybody who comes from every background, whether they're African American or Hispanic, they're women or they're gay, to all think and act alike. That's not diversity. That's just what they look like, where they're from. But you want us to all act alike. That's not diversity. So I got an opportunity to see the contradiction. And I think what makes organizations great is diverse thinking. And so I think he did see the contradiction.
So push back a little. Next, over here.
Hi, my name's Laura Grover. I work here in Boston, an insurance company. This morning at the keynote, Carla talked about the importance of cultivating relationships as you progressed in your career. And as you talked about your different career experiences, it sounded like in at least a couple of those, you learned of those next opportunities through relationships you had built. Did you know at the time they were going to be important and you were strategically building those types of relationships, or was it just a lucky coincidence you happen to meet the right people and stay in touch to then be offered those future opportunities?
So the answer is both. When I was in the White House, I was very strategic. Mm. I decided as a 30-year-old lawyer, I wanted to be a university president. I had no right whatsoever to decide I wanted to be a university president. But I decided I wanted to change the world, and I figured the way to change the world was to impact young minds, right? Mm-hmm. And where do you do that? You create an environment where you expose them and have a catalyst, create an environment where catalysts for change. And the way do you do that? You do that on a university campus. So I made that decision. And so, therefore, I was very purposeful. I set out a route. I left the White House at the end of 3 years. I became the first Deputy Secretary of Education. I picked up a couple of honorary degrees, which you can do when you're in the White House. People asked me to come speak. I said, you know, you give me an honorary degree. Okay. I picked up a few of those. I now have 10. Marion must have 30.
I'm 21.
21, sorry. And I was very purposeful, and I therefore ended up where I went and who I met made a difference. A couple of people in Boston, I started because I wanted to come to Boston, definitely made a difference in my life. Saul Gittleman at Tufts and some other folks up here have through my career have in fact helped me through the way. So definitely that was purposeful in terms of career. The Walmart thing, the guy I told you about who I had lunch with who was lobbying for Walmart, his name is Tony Podesta. He is John Podesta's brother. Yeah. You know John Podesta is? John Podesta was the chairman of Hillary's campaign. So John and Tony lived across the street from me when they were in law school. Now, Tony's older than I am, and John's about the same age. So I've known them that long. So that was just happenstance. And in fact, if you go to WikiLeaks, you'll see my emails in WikiLeaks. Because I was like, I did that just as a sort of thing. I went like, I wonder if my emails are in WikiLeaks. And I went in, and there they were. To John, I was like amazed. I was like, you know, and so are my travel vouchers. When I traveled, it was like, says, you know, when I was working in the White House, and I traveled to UNESCO conferences. So strange to see them. Yeah. Everything's there.
So does that help? Thank you. Yes. Okay, let's get over here, right over here.
Hi, Beth Young. I'm in global marketing for a med device company. My question is that I think there's value in the differences between men and women. So I want to know from you how you've managed through the years to still be a feminine, girly, you know, those stereotypes. We all are. Deep down inside, I enjoy being a girl. But when I'm at my work, I feel that what brings you forward is more of a, for lack of a better word, that assertive kind of mannish behavior.
Okay.
So how do you balance those? Because
all right, let's hear from Margaret. How do you balance that?
You know, I've always been, what you see is what you get. And that's at home, at work, or here, or anywhere. I mean, what you see right now is exactly the way I am all the time. I've never been, people have tried to get me to act in different ways in different places. I'm incapable of it. You can ask my children. I have two sons. And one of them in particular, my younger son, is like, Mom, you know, cool it. But I find that, for me anyway, I bet you too, Marion, right?
Yeah, you have to be your authentic self. You have to be who you are, and don't look to the outside to certify that. At home, I have a husband and two sons. We both have sons together. I do not open a mayonnaise jar. I don't move furniture. I don't put gas in my car except on rare occasions. And yes, I have a counter full of makeup. And my husband appreciates it, but it's just the way we are together. And we're married 53 years. But at work, like Margaret says, hey, I pull out those steel-tipped cleats. Next.
Hi, my name is Teresa. I'm in IT, and I'm just going to say this. I don't expect an answer. But how qualified and smart does a woman have to be president? That's what I want to know.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah. Okay, yep. Did everybody hear that? Yeah, how qualified and smart does a woman have to be president? We could be here all day. Yeah. Thank you for that.
Wait. Yeah. The next question is, you've been around in different parts of the country. We're from the Northeast, we're Yankees, and I want to understand, how do you deal with people in other parts of the country? I've traveled, but I've never worked in Arkansas or Georgia or the South. And how hard was it for them to accept you?
It was very difficult. You know, one is the accent. I have an accent. They think I have an accent. So it was very difficult. I want to say something else about this part of the country, and I know we're getting to the end here. People, you know, we live in Massachusetts. People think it's very progressive. I'm working with a group of women now who are looking at the status of women and where we are. We're losing ground. When I was the president of Lesley, we had more women presidents of colleges in Massachusetts than men. More women than men. We're not even close today. Not even close. We're a small percentage today. And in the state colleges, we're a very small percentage. And we're about to do a study to look at all of that, all right? But we need to be paying attention, because those of us who fought very hard early, you know, you're hearing a lot about what's happening in terms of policy, in terms of women's choice, and what's been happening in different states in terms of choice in other issues for women, in women's health. But the status of women, you know, if you take your eye off the ball, which we have, we can fall back. And I think in Massachusetts we have. And we certainly haven't gotten ahead. And I think that's one of the things, you know, Massachusetts, we've never had a woman governor. Come on, you know, or, you know, we now have a woman senator. We have two women congresspeople. But you know, and you know, we're not in terms of being progressive, in terms of women, we're not doing all that great. And a lot of other states have done a lot better than we have. An old boys network here, which is pretty significant and pretty tight. And if you remember the front page of the Globe when it had the sort of new vault that had the people who were sort of run the city underground. It was the old boys network had one woman who was from Fidelity. That was it. So people need to pay attention to who's running this city, and women need to stand up and stand together and stand behind other women and yes. To forge ahead.
We're going to wrap it up on that note. These two women in line, and these two women in line, Margaret and I will meet you right outside that door, because another program is coming into this room, and we will take your questions. Thank you.